Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani and I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest will be Wes Jackson, the founder and president of the Land Institute. And when he comes on, I'll let him tell us more about what the Land Institute does. I want to tell you some things going on in and around the city that you can participate in. Of course, I want to share my recipe of the week with you and then invite my guest on. So let's start with some of the things going on in and around the New York area. And as I've said before, if you have events that are going on around the area, feel free to send me an email at bhavani@iegreen.com, and I'd be happy to share it with my listeners. On June 23rd, Edible Manhattan is presenting The Big Chill, and that's taking place at the Brooklyn Brewery from 6 to 9, and it will be a wonderful time to get together with other like-minded people. There will be a wonderful buffet-style, family-style meal being served, along with great summer ales and IPAs at the Brooklyn Brewery. You can find out more information at the Edible Manhattan website. On June 30th, a very important rally is organizing to ban fracking and stop the Port Ambrose liquefied port that they're trying to build off of Jones Beach in the Atlantic Ocean. This is going to take place at the Grand Hyatt on June 30th. Governor Cuomo will be there hosting a major fundraiser, and New Yorkers Against Fracking will be there and hope you can join us. It will be from 5:30 to 7 at the Grand Hyatt on East 42nd Street. Fracking is, I'm sure most of you are aware, is a process of releasing gas that is sequestered, that is being that is living in the rock, the shale rock underneath the ground, and they go and they drill a mile deep into the surface of the earth, and then they take a 90-degree turn and go out horizontally for a long time. I don't know how many miles, and then they create an explosion, basically, with thousands and millions of gallons of water along with chemicals that they won't tell us what they are, and they do that to create an explosion to release the gas, and that gas also goes into the atmosphere, and then there's loads of wastewater from it. You know, you've heard about people's water catching on fire. That's all from fracking. So we really need to stop this process and really make a move towards more sustainable and renewable energy sources. So where this proposed Port Ambrose liquefied port would be is right where we're also talking about doing a wind farm. So wind is certainly a better way to invest, and so we need everybody out there to let Governor Cuomo know. Also on July 6th, a Tin House Music Concert Series continues at Restoration Farm, and that's from 2 to 5 the first Sunday of every month during the season. And it's a great time to come out, hear some great music. There's an open mic starting at 2 for the first hour. And then they have bands that they have contracted each week or each month to entertain. And it's a really nice time. So if you can, come on out for that. July 9th, 23rd, August 6th, and August 20th. IE Green is hosting farm-to-table cooking classes out at our homestead here in Old Westbury. We will be harvesting vegetables directly from the organic farm or organic garden and then learning how to prepare delicious, savory dishes. So sign up for that. You can. There's a link from my website at iegreen.com for those cooking classes. Also, on July 24th, I am hosting, along with someone from Morgan Stanley, a socially responsible investing dinner. If you are looking for ways that you can invest and make your money work for you without supporting corporations that are investing in fossil fuels or fossil fuel companies or the likes of Monsanto, come on out for this socially responsible investing dinner party. And learn how you can do that. We did it this year for our first time with the support of 350.org or the inspiration of 350.org, asking everybody to divest from fossil fuel companies. I also wanted to divest from any biotech companies dealing with chemicals that are polluting our earth. And I've done that, and it's really great and feels good. And the money that we invested did very well this year. So I'd like to share that with all of you listening. So you can find out more information about that on my website as well. This week I am hosting a couple here from Italy who hosted me and another slow food person, as well as the following year, myself and my husband, when we went over to Turin, Italy, for the International Slow Food Conference called Terra Madre. And this couple has hosted for the past 4 Terra Madres, which happens every other year. So over the last 8 years, they've had 2 rooms in their apartment that they share with people coming in for the conference. And it's just been a wonderful sharing of cultures and traditions and making new friends. And it's just wonderful to be able to reciprocate and host them here. And so right after this show, we will be heading out east to Slow Food East End's event called Celebration, which is in Montauk. On our way, we'll be stopping in some vineyards and some farms and show them the North Fork as well. So that's always a fun thing to do and share with more people. So if you are have not made a trip out to the North Fork or the South Fork and visited some local vineyards and organic farms, I recommend doing it. It's really a wonderful day trip. I want to share my recipe with you, coconut crusted tofu with mango curry. And this was inspired because I came across a case of very delicious-looking mangoes that I just had to buy. And then they were in my kitchen getting very ripe, and so I decided I needed to make something with them. So, Allah, here is my coconut-crusted tofu with mango curry. I first took the cake of organic, extra-firm tofu, and I cut it into 12 equal slices. And then I laid the slices out onto a kitchen towel or a paper towel with another one on top just to absorb any of the water and lightly press down. In addition to the tofu, you're going to need 3/4 cup of shredded coconut, 1/4 cup of cardamom, 1/4 cup of rice milk or almond milk, some coconut oil, 1 tablespoon of red curry paste, 1 can of coconut milk, 1 onion chopped, 1/2 cucumber peeled, 2 tablespoons peppers. Now, I actually had a pepper salsa kind of that I had made last year that I had in the freezer, and it's an assortment of jalapeno and serrano peppers. So it just, is spicy peppers. So you can just get 1 jalapeno pepper and slice that up if you don't have something like that already in your refrigerator. 2 tablespoons of cilantro, juice of 1 lime, 1 tablespoon chopped cilantro for garnish, 2 mangoes peeled and chopped, and 1 tablespoon sugar. And that's optional. And you can use sugar, you can use agave, you can use honey, anything to just make the curry a little sweeter if you prefer that. That's really optional. So after you've pressed out your tofu, you're going to combine the coconut and the cardamom in a shallow dish, and I use a pie pan, and dip the tofu into the rice milk or the almond milk, and then into the coconut mixture so that you're breading both sides of the tofu with the coconut. And then you're going to fry them in 1 tablespoon of the coconut oil until they're golden brown on both sides. And I was only able to fit 6 slices in my pan at a time because I wanted them to cook evenly. So you can do 6 and then repeat and do the other 6. And in between repeating, wipe out the pan of any loose coconuts that you're starting with a fresh, clean pan each time. Then in a food processor, I cut the mango up, as I had said, but 1 mango is going to get blended with the coconut milk, and the other mango will stay chunky and go into the curry at the end. So you take the 1 mango with the coconut milk and the curry paste, and you're going to pulse that in a food processor. Add some salt and pepper to taste, and just hold on to that mixture for a minute. You're going to saute one onion in coconut oil. Then you're going to add the cucumbers and the peppers, and then you're going to add that coconut mango mixture. And cook for about 5 minutes, just to allow the seasonings to come together. Add the remaining mango, 1 tablespoon of the cilantro, the juice of 1 lime, and taste it and add a little more salt or pepper if you'd like. And this is when you can decide if you want to make it a little sweeter and add a tablespoon of sugar or a teaspoon of agave. Remember, agave is sweeter than sugar, so go light on that if you're going to use agave. And then you pour the curry sauce right over those tofu cutlets and serve them on a platter and garnish it with some fresh cilantro. And you can also put some limes around the platter to make it look nice. And that's it. It's really delicious, comes together very quickly, and I highly recommend it. If you do make it, please send me feedback. I love hearing from all of you. You can write me at bhavani@ieatgreen.com. Before I introduce my guest, I just want to ask you all to go to my website. There's petitions there where you can take action. Right now there is a situation where the House of Representatives is going to be voting on whether to gut the new healthy school lunch program that we've worked so hard to try to implement into the lunches. School lunch for so many kids is really their one meal of the day. And we really needed to improve the school lunch, and we've worked very hard to try to make those improvements. Michelle Obama has been working very hard along with Chef's Move to Schools. And so this has, you know, been wonderful to improve the school lunch program. And yet, the House of Representatives, recognizing that some schools are having a hard time meeting the budget to make these improvements, rather than finding the money to help the schools, they're looking to go back to the old ways and make it so that they do not have to make the school lunches healthier. So please sign the petition and let your representatives know that you really want this healthy school lunch programs to continue. Also, we need to let the Obama administration know that we do not want this Cove Point gas terminal that they're trying to build. It's a fracking gas terminal outside of Maryland. And they're trying to push that through, and we really want to let President Obama know that we do not support that terminal. And also, there's a big move to try to prevent companies from being able to say natural on their products. Natural really means nothing, but so many people see something labeled natural and they think it's healthy. And yet it really can be filled with lots of chemicals, preservatives, and genetically modified ingredients. So we want to push the Obama administration to remove the permission to use natural on products when they're not really natural. And we could really use everybody's help in signing that petition. And what else? Of course, big food companies, the Grocers Manufacturer Association, and others are suing Vermont for passing the labeling law that will require labeling of any products that contain genetically modified ingredients. Of course, this is not a surprise. We expected that. So there's things you can do. So please send this email around, show your support for Vermont and for the labeling laws. And you can find all that on my website. Okay? So now it's my pleasure to introduce to you my guest today, Wes Jackson, the founder and president of the Land Institute. He has been a farmer from Kansas from way back, and he started, first got his degree in biology from Kansas Wesleyan University, then a master's degree in botany from the University of Kansas, and finally a doctorate in genetics from North Carolina State University before he moved to California and chaired one of the country's first environmental studies program at California State University in Sacramento. In 1976, he returned back to Kansas to start the Land Institute. He's also an author of many, many books, and he's recognized as a leader in the international movement for sustainable agriculture. He was a Pew Conservation Scholar in 1990, a MacArthur Fellow in 1992, and he received the Right Livelihood Award in 2000. And Life magazine included him as one of the 18 individuals predicted to be among the 100 most important Americans of the 20th century. And that's quite an honor. Wes, are you with us?
I am. Yes, I'm here.
Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Sure. So before we get started, I'd love you to take a moment to explain to everyone listening what the Land Institute is and what it does.
Well, we're a nonprofit education research organization. We say devoted to a search for sustainable alternatives, primarily in agriculture, but also in energy and other. Our primary organizing idea or concept is that nature's ecosystems, essentially all of them, that are land-based, feature perennials grown in mixtures, and that agriculture reversed that starting 10,000 years ago at the eastern end of the Mediterranean when wheat was picked up out of the Zagros Mountains of western Iran. And then, of course, later in the Orient, rice, and then in the Americas, corn. Humans are primarily grass seed eaters and secondarily legume seed eaters. We put those in the category of grains, and they represent 70 to 75% of our calories. On a global basis, it's about 75%, and on about the same amount of agricultural acreage. And yet, and so agriculture is, in my view, almost inherently destructive, in that with the annual, you're tearing the ground up every year, or you're treating it with an herbicide, as in no-till, and that at the level of vegetables and some fruits, where the scale is so small and represents such a tiny percent of our calories, you know, we can get away with it. But on a global basis, soil erosion, land degradation generally, according to the United Nations, we're losing about 30 million acres a year. And it's also land use is number two as a source of greenhouse gases, right behind power plants and ahead of all transportation. And that if some of that, of course, is deforestation in the tropics. However, if you subtract off the part that is for opening up for agriculture, primarily corn and soybeans, then agriculture, grain agriculture, is about equal to all transportation. So it's a there's a fundamental flaw associated with grain agriculture.
Mm-hmm. So actually, one of my questions was, how do you...
annual condition.
I'm sorry,
because
say that
the
again?
Annual condition. Well, because of their annuals, and therefore the idea that nature's to be subdued or ignored, and that's necessary if we're to eat, and yet that's the idea that has ricocheted through civilization for 10 millennia, and I think is part of that dualism problem that we've had, we say, going back to the Greeks and Hebrews, but I think it went back to early Neolithic.
Well, I was going to ask you, how do you turn an annual grain into a perennial crop? But actually, it sounds like most of these annual grains were perennials first before we turned them into annuals.
Never.
No?
No, none of them. No,
okay.
They were not. They were annuals, and that's one reason we went after them, because what we call the perenniating tissue that is necessary for generation to generation is the big seeded annual that can compete against weed pressure. And so that's how we got started on it. And also there's a fundamental problem with the perennial. Our ancestors could not have developed perennial grains, and we can now, and for this reason. Annuals tend to self, that is, accept their own pollen, and that is very tight inbreeding, the mm-hmm. tightest form of inbreeding. Perennials tend to outcross. So if a mutant, when a mutant arises within an annual, it very quickly goes to what we call the double recessive condition, and if it is lethal, it gets eliminated fast. If it's a desirable trait, like shatter resistance, the resistance to shattering, it can get fixed very quickly. Perennials tend to outcross, and what we geneticists call genetic load builds up in the population. So imagine, say, in Mesopotamia, 8,000 years ago, a group of people that had been making considerable progress in increasing the yield of wheat, both through some breeding and through agronomic arrangements. Imagine they had said, you know, there's this perennial over there, or this plant that just keeps coming up, but it doesn't produce much seed, and the seeds are small. So, but it does show some promise. So how about us going to work on that? Well, had they tried it, they very quickly, they'd probably selected SIBs, that is, two plants from the same mother plant, and there would have been a lot of aborted embryos up and down that inflorescence. So they would have had to have thousands of plants and thousands of trials, and they wouldn't have had the computational power that we have today. But we can do now what they couldn't do, and that's what we're doing with, well, two of our species that were wild species of intermediate wheatgrass. We've been domesticating. Leedy Hahn's getting good results on that. And, in fact, there's 90 acres of it that'll be harvested this fall in Minnesota. 80 of it already sold to Patagonia, that's kind of getting into food, and 10 acres that's going to make whiskey. We got a stick mm-hmm. of basics here now. And and then David Van Tassel, and he's a breeder. Both these guys are, you know, PhDs from land-grant institutions, but they are not typical of your usual PhD grad in genetics at places like that. But David Van Tassel, working with a relative of sunflower, in the same, doing the same thing. Also, we're crossing the Kernza with wheat, and Dr. Xuan Wang is on that, and he has his wheat hybrids. He's also crossed them with other various crosses, but some 20 different sites in 8 different countries. His perennial trials are being grown out. And then Stan Cox, working with sorghum. Sorghum here is used as a livestock feed, but we have a postdoc here from Uganda, and also so some of Stan's germplasm, even though he has perennialism and winter hardiness, will be going to Uganda to be used as a perennial in various trials. And so the thing is this this is something we can now do in our time. We do use molecular markers. We do know gene splicing. We mostly breed, and thanks to the tremendous computational power of our time, why we're able to do what our ancestors could not have done.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain the difference between crossbreeding and splicing with, you know, like genetically modified ingredients? Because I know a lot of times when people who are not in your profession hear crossbreeding, they think GMO, and obviously it's very different. Is there any negative consequences?
Well, the GMO is
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I didn't let you finish. I'm sorry. Finish.
I was just saying, you know, people don't...
explain crossbreeding. Okay.
Go ahead. This happens all the time. Go ahead.
Yeah. All right. You take, for instance, our Kernza, which is intermediate wheat grass or Thinnopyrum intermedium, and you cross it with wheat. And then you make take those hybrids and cross them times themselves and see what you get. Or you may take those hybrids and back cross to both parents. We do that. And you see what you get. And you're hoping to pick up the perennial trait. What we know, what we found after several years, well, it didn't take several years to find it out, but when we back cross to the perennial, with the annual times the perennial, we're more likely to pick up the perennial characteristics than we are when we back cross to the annual. That is, first of all, I should say, we do not believe there is a gene for perennialism. That perennialism is a way of life, and the genes for it are spread across the genome. We don't necessarily, we don't know where they are, but that's just breeding, and that's what's been going on, you know, that's probably been going on for 10,000 years. But when you do the gene splicing, that's finding a gene that is, for instance, a gene like Roundup Ready for soybeans. Mm-hmm. So you find the molecule, gene, the gene for resistance to Roundup. You introduce that gene into your crop, and then you can plant it out, and then you can sell the herbicide that'll kill everything else except that crop. The gene jockeys do that.
Right.
In my view, there's a great social injustice associated with it in that, you know, let's say, well, I happen to know Interstate 80 starts in San Francisco and ends in New York. And so let's say somebody, let's say that represents the genome, and somebody decides to put a toll gate at about Berkeley and charge for the trip across the country, we would consider that not allowable, and that's the part that bothers me a bit about what is happening with the gene splicing. I'm far more concerned about the social injustice part of all of this than I am what we might call the ecological consequences.
Although the ecological consequences are great.
Pardon?
I was saying, although the ecological consequences can be quite destructive as well.
Well, they're destructive in that, let's say that gene were spliced into the sorghum, and then you have Johnson grass, which is an awful weed, a very aggressive weed. Tetraploid that will freely cross with sorghum, you're going to have Roundup-resistant Johnson grass. So you got that's a big nuisance. That'd be a big nuisance.
Well, they're also now talking about. I know Scotts was going to make one of their grass seeds genetically modified, which you know will spread and cross over, just because all GMOs do, which would be a problem with all our animals grazing on grass.
Well, I don't know. See, this is the problem. First of all, there are too many unknowns, and that's another reason to be far more cautious than we have been. But, you know, we ought to at least acknowledge, for instance, that those viruses that are floating around in this world, they've been here a long time. Those viruses are doing things like, I understand, I haven't checked up on this from years ago, I should have by now, but the gene for hemoglobin is in a soybean plant. And, you know, there are a lot of these genes are being moved around by the viruses. I don't see any see that that's necessarily a license for us to go moving them around. But, you know, we ought to at least acknowledge that those viruses are going to be moving those genes around across plant families and so on. So, mm-hmm. you know, in the evolutionary scheme, we know that when humans start manipulating, that they're almost always unforeseen and unforeseeable consequences.
Mm-hmm. So now, is the Land Institute working to make wheat and soybeans and most of our grain and legume crops perennials now? And do you have that technology to be able to do that?
Well, first of all, realize we're a small outfit out here in Kansas, and well, there are about 31 of us year-round, 40 during the summer. So, you know, I mean, I would like us to perennialize what's been the primary killer of this continent, which is corn, and also soybeans, which is the number two killer in terms of soil erosion and the fossil fuel dependency and chemical contamination of the land and water and so on. Corn's going to be hard, and so is soybean. We've not started those. First of all, you'd probably want to start in Mexico or Hawaii, and because of the light reality, the sensitivity to day length and so on. I think that the long-term goal would be to perennialize the major crops and domesticate promising wild perennials like the Kernza and like the Silphium, which will be an important oilseed crop. We've crossed, David Van Tassel's also been working on perennial sunflower, and he's devoting more time now to the development of the relative of a sunflower, a different genus, the Silphium. And this is one of the big things that we hope to launch, and that is an inventory of the wild, herbaceous, as opposed to woody, perennial, as opposed to annual, plants that could be domesticated, and then put them in mixtures, because if we stop with perennial monoculture, we've missed half the point. The point is a perennial polyculture that will mimic, to a certain extent, a never-plowed native prairie. And, of course, what set me off way back in the 70s was being able to, well, first of all, I read the General Accounting Office study about soil erosion, and it looked to me like it was as bad in the 70s as when the Soil Conservation Service was formed. And I thought, how can this be? You know, thousands of miles, terraces, grass, waterways, and so on, an energetic and imaginative leadership and so on. And yet I could take my students to the Kernza Prairie, no fossil fuel dependency, no introduction of chemicals we haven't evolved with, no soil erosion beyond natural replacement levels, and yet here it sits. And right across the, right down the road, is muddy water in the streams and gullies in the fields. And that's the story of the Midwest and the Great Plains. Primarily, it was also the story of New England before they went over the mountains to start farming there and growing most of the cowries for the United States.
Mm-hmm. But if we were doing mimicking even of these crops, if you had a prairie and then you had to harvest what was in the prairie, wouldn't just that process of harvesting cause disruption in the soil just by that nature?
No. Well, the prairie has been getting harvested for millions of years. The large herbivores have been harvesting it. And we, in fact, look to the primary management schemes to feature fire and grazing. We have a prairie here, about 160 acres. We have 28 bison on it. And we keep that there because that's our standard. That is the only true economy that features material recycling. It runs on contemporary sunlight. We harvest the bison and actually feed bison meat at the Prairie Festival. There's a system that is sustainable. Now, once you start pulling off grains, then you're going to have to add phosphorus and potassium. However, what we want in the mix is the legume so that we get biological nitrogen fixation. Right now, the energy cost for nitrogen in America's fields is about equal to the energy cost equal to traction, the tractors, combines, and so on. So the Haber-Bosch process, which, by the way, in my view and the view of Vaclav Smil at the University of Manitoba, the most important invention of the 20th century was 1909, when two Germans learned how to take atmospheric nitrogen and turn it into ammonia. As we all know, 78% of the atmosphere is nitrogen, but it's one of the strongest bonds in nature, and to make it available for the plants to use. So what the commercial fertilizer people do is use natural gas as the feedstock to make the nitrogen fertilizer. And that's the reason the standing crop of humanity is now over 7 billion. If we didn't have Haber-Bosch, Vaclav Smil has calculated 40% of humanity would not be here today. So that's the reality we're dealing with, is how to get biological nitrogen fixation so that we are not contributing to the greenhouse gases in the growing of our food. And the prairie does not. The prairie actually sequesters carbon. So the perennial polycultures for grain that we're talking about would quit being a primary source of greenhouse gases the way agriculture is today and actually sequester carbon. So this is the reason that this stuff is beginning to catch on. The United Nations, the Royal Society has endorsed it, so has the National Science Foundation, the National Research Council, the people working on biodiversity, the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment Report said that agriculture is the number one threat to wild biodiversity. So, you know, we've got to solve the problem of agriculture instead of just featuring solving problems in agriculture, because that's a Sisyphus effort and we're losing.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it is. It's, you know, hearing it from you, it's so complicated, you know, for a layperson to even grasp all that you're talking about. And yet, those of us working here in the movement to try to raise awareness about agriculture and how agriculture is adding to greenhouse gas emissions, it's just amazing, all the knowledge you have. Let's take a couple-minute break first, Wes, and when we come back, I want to hear exactly what you're going to say, okay? Everyone, don't go anywhere. Okay, I'm talking with Wes Jackson from the Land Institute, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. We'll be right back.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Wes Jackson, the founder and president of the Land Institute, working to create a more sustainable agricultural system that we can all live by. Wes, are you with me?
I'm with you.
Great.
Here I am.
So, you know, you were talking about the nitrogen in the atmosphere and, you know, how they were able to sequester the nitrogen and turn it into ammonia. How are they able to, if they're able to get that nitrogen that's in the atmosphere and they use that for commercial fertilizers, what's the negative aspect of that? What is wrong with
well,
that?
Well, number one, it's a huge energy waste, and number two, when they pour it on the ground into annual systems that leak, less than half of it, around half of it, we'll say to be safe, is taken up by the plant. The rest gets into the soil and the water and heads in the Midwest down the Mississippi and creates a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico that is about as big as the state of New Jersey, which affects the fisheries and so on. It's energy wasting, and also, you know, places like Des Moines have to spend millions of dollars to get the nitrogen out of their water. It's harmful to livestock and babies. You know, it's we don't have those kinds of concentrations of nitrogen in our water naturally.
Right.
So it's a huge problem. But biological nitrogen fixation is elegant. And I don't know if I can get this across on the radio. I usually like a blackboard. But here's the story. That it takes about, I think it's 350 atmospheres, that's a pressure, and 400 degrees C of temperature to be involved in breaking those bonds and making ammonia, which is then available to plants. So you got it, 350 and 400. That's huge. Now, biologically, the bacteria associated with the roots of legumes do it at 3/4 of one atmosphere and at ambient temperature using 21 enzymes to make it happen. Now, that is total biological. And out on that prairie, about a quarter of the plants are legumes and are very aggressive at nitrogen fixation. There are other sources of biological nitrogen fixation also on that prairie. But that's one reason that we talk about the efficiencies that are inherent within the natural integrities of an ecosystem. Whether you're talking about a forest or a prairie or an alpine meadow or whatever, this is what is shaken down over millions of years and what humans destroy in the interest of getting the food. So this is this represents what some would call a paradigm shift in our thinking about growing food. And one of the things I have to say, and I give a lot of talks around, and my friends, the various people involved in food and whatnot, will tell me, well, Wes, we start with food and then we'll get to soil. Well, I can tell you it's not happened, that we are so overly focused on the food that we do not talk about the soil erosion, partly because most of the calories are grown in flyover country, and a lot of the food emphasis has been on the vegetables, which represent something like 3% of our agricultural landscape. And so what I'm pleading for is for those that are primarily focusing food, those are the ones that can become the core of a constituency that will start paying attention to the larger agricultural landscape and because ultimately we have to have a constituency in Washington that says it's time for a paradigm shift for agriculture generally. And that would include the chemicals, the soil erosion, the fossil fuel dependency, the climate aspect. And I'll put it this way. If we don't get sustainability in agriculture first, it's not going to happen. Because agriculture ultimately has a discipline standing behind it of ecology and evolutionary biology. The materials sector, the industrial sector, has no discipline standing behind it to inform a research agenda. So that's why my friends that are in the food movement and sustainable ag and local community supported and all that have to help the rest of us that are in mid-continent.
And how do you suggest ordinary citizens do that to help address these problems? What can we do?
That's the question my kids ask, you know. And so, Dr. Doom, what can we as ordinary citizens
right.
do about
this? Because,
this?
I mean, there are a lot of people that recognize that this is a problem and want to be constructive in some way, but don't know how to focus how to focus ourselves.
I don't know either. I don't know either. In fact, here's the problem as I see it. The people that are doing the local, the organic, the food, you know, that are doing all that, they're busy. And yet they're the ones that have the energies of transcendence for change. Meanwhile, the policymakers are not involved at the scale, you know, the here and now and right on the ground. And they don't have the energies of transcendence. But somehow or another, we're going to have a movement that goes beyond just the individual and the community. It's got to be something where at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, there is a fundamental change in the way, for instance, the subsidies are done. I mean, for
right.
instance,
well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, the policymakers make money.
Yeah.
Being friends with these
right.
big biotech companies, and, you know, they get paid off,
right.
you know. I mean, it's a really
right.
horrible, insidious situation.
Right. Well, take the pipeline, for instance. You know, that got organized and is, we don't know whether we're going to win on that or not. You know, that was sort of self-organizing. It took people that would say, huh, here is the issue, and I'm going to get with that issue. And I'm going to help create a movement. And so we may lose on the pipeline, but the important thing is that the awareness is not yet there about the how fast our soils are going. And, you know, here's the first thing. Those that remember the periodic chart of the elements in their chemistry classrooms, in the upper third of that chart are 20-some elements that go into life, whether it's a redwood or a whale or a corn plant or a soybean or a petunia or a butcher hog or a cow or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And only four of those 20-some elements are in the atmospheric commons. The rest of them are in the soil. So what we've been doing is treating soil like dirt, and we've got to change that. And so my feeling is the best way to do that is to get herbaceous, perennial, seed-producing polycultures for grain production.
Mm-hmm.
And bring the ecosystem concept to inform a research agenda.
You know, when you talk about the soil in that way and how we have to look at agriculture, it's so much like that also with the body, when they are breaking the body apart into all these little parts and not looking at the whole body. I mean, when you treat only one thing and you don't see how it's all interconnected. I mean, our whole planet is so interconnected, and agriculture and the life that lives in the soil is so connected, and I
right.
think so often You know, people are only looking at one part, and if they're only looking to grow the food and not thinking of soil as life but just as dirt, as you were saying, you're going to lose that. So before we run out of time, can you share with us any, you know, whether it's organizations or policymakers or something that I can, you know, encourage my listeners to do to participate, because I'm always asking them to pick a topic, pick something to help make a change. And, you know, and especially our young people, they want to make a change, and they really are at a loss as to which way to go.
Right. Well, what I would say is this is a time for leadership to arise. It's totally open for anybody that wants to get involved and help create a movement. There are lots of us that are concerned about sustainable agriculture. But the problem is, of course, we're scattered. And so there really is, I mean, there are a lot of people that go to Washington for sustainable ag type stuff, but most of it is for here and now. Wendell Berry and I and Fred Kirschman a few years ago took to Washington what we called a 50-year farm bill. Now, we pretty much knew that they weren't going to pick up on it because, you know, it's like trying to take the Copernican Revolution to the Pope in 1600. You know, that's not going to get far. But people are beginning to get an awareness, A, about the importance of perennials, and B, about the importance of the ecosystem concept, because these ecosystems have, you know, there's a guy at Stanford and Carnegie Institute of Washington, Chris Field, had a paper in Science years ago. Natural ecosystems generally have greater net primary production than the human-managed systems that take their place. So if we start there and begin to build a movement around that, who can do it? Well, we're busy here at the Land Institute. I mean, our people are out right now in the plots. And and we're a long ways from Washington, and so on. So I just say anybody that has a burn-on about this could begin to think about organizing. And in a similar way that ZPG got organized back at the time of Paul Ehrlich, who wrote the book, and Zero Population Growth got started. So that's the kind of thing. There's plenty of room for people to, you know,
take that leadership.
To begin that leadership.
And are the farmers that live out by you, because here I'm in New York, so there's small sustainable farmers that I know of here on Long Island and up in the Hudson Valley, but out by you where there's the vast amount of land and most of the monocrop farmers live in the middle of the country, are those farmers interested in making that transition to a more sustainable agricultural system?
Sure. Our farmers, you know, it's just that we don't have anything to offer now. You know, when I first published on this, I said this is going to take 50 to 100 years. And so we're actually a little ahead of schedule. But farmers, look, you can imagine who won't be interested. Number one, the seed houses. Number two, the farm machinery people, because there are fewer passes. Number three, the fertilizer people. Number four, the pesticide people. The reward will go to the farmer and the landscape more than the suppliers of inputs. So farmers just want to make a profit, that's all. They're not opposed to this. The problem is that we don't have, except the very few that have worked with, in an experimental sort of way. Although this fall in Minnesota there will be an organization of some 70 farmers. Some of them are going to be planting out the Kernza. And Leedy Hahn has a shatter-resistant gene in the Kernza. It's called the Q gene. It's at 15% frequency. He thinks in 3 to 5 years or so he'll have it around 100%. That'll be a game-changer there. But that's just with a monoculture, you see. So... You know, this could happen fairly fast, but what we need to do is get it more on the national agenda.
Absolutely. So people can also find out about the Land Institute at thelandinstitute.org, correct? And can they
That's
make,
right.
They can make donations as well and help your work.
And then you can send us a whole bunch of money, and then we'll send you back a thank you note.
Okay, that sounds great, Wes.
I was just out there.
I was going to say your quote that says, you know, if you can complete your life, I don't know it word for word, but if you can complete your life's work within your lifetime, you're thinking too small, or you're not thinking big enough. And I love that.
Not thinking big enough.
I love that.
I was just with the Food Hub people last week up the valley from you folks, and there's quite a gathering going on there. I don't know if you know about the Food Hub, but
I do. But we'll have to save that for another. We'll have to save that for another interview. I'll have you back on, you know, in another year, and we'll talk about the progress you're making, because I'm sure you will with all the money we're going to send you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Wes, so much.
All right.
Everybody out there who's been listening, thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Wes Jackson from the Land Institute, and I'm Bhavani from IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network.